tonight on Arena. Greg Jenner on the history of celebrity from the Bronze Age up to the silver screen, and new albums from Lucinda Williams, Delush and Ezra Furman up for review. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. A fascination with celebrity is entrenched in contemporary culture, and in his latest book, Dead Famous, social historian Greg Jenner explores the historical origins of celebrity, why we are dazzled by celebrities, and what that might say about us. And Greg joins us now. I'll give the full title of the book a little bit later in the interview, because it's a very long full title, Greg. But let's start with just that word, celebrity. You know, because there are so many possibilities here. We could be talking about fame. We could be talking about notoriety. We could be talking about vacuity and absolutely no talent. What are you talking about when you're talking about celebrity?
It's a great question. It's actually quite a complicated word. It's got a long and messy history. It didn't even mean a famous person until, well, probably the 1830s or 40s. Celebrity is an economic system. It's an industry. It's all about the attention economy and us wanting to pay money to access the glamorous, interesting lives of people that we've heard of. So it's a sort of form of being known. But more than that, it's also where we are willing to pay cash to find out what's going on in these people's lives. So it's all about the money, and it's also about the personal life. And of course, it needs the media to kind of prop it up. So as a historian, I went looking for when it started, and I'm pretty confident that it's at least 300 years old.
All right. Once you say things like economy and the mass media and the other aspects that you mentioned in that definition, it sounds very, very contemporary. You'll give me why you can get it back to about the 1700s in a minute. But the full title of the book is Dead Famous, An Unexpected History of Celebrity from Bronze Age to Silver Screen. Greg Jenner, yep. Bronze Age was a little bit before the 17th century, or the 1700s rather.
You spotted it. Yeah, no, it's...
I saw that.
The truth is that celebrity builds on earlier forms of reputation. The most famous one will actually be the word fame itself. We know what the word fame means. We all understand it in our modern context. But to the Romans and to the Greeks, fame was quite a specific thing. In fact, it was two different things. It's quite complicated when we look at the actual original poetry and sources. The Romans, the Greeks, they talked about glory and this idea of a reputation that would last after death, which is, you know, a rather grand thing. And we sort of ascribe it to poets and great musicians and, you know, people who will live long in the memory and maybe have an impact on culture and society. So we still use that a little bit. But the Romans also talked about fame as a really short, short scale, very invasive, strange type of reputation. And the word fame comes from the Latin fari, and that means to speak or gossip about. And there was a Roman goddess called Fama, where we get the word from, fame, and she was terrifying. She was like Godzilla. She was huge. She was covered in eyes and tongues and mouths and ears. She was she never slept. She would grow bigger the more someone would gossip about you, and she would stalk the landscape, hunting people down. So if people gossiped about you, fame came looking for you like some sort of giant predator. So we talk about the reason I've got Bronze Age in the book there in that subtitle is because fame and celebrity, although they're actually quite different, they actually do intersect. And we do have to acknowledge that there is this long-standing tradition going way back to the Romans and Greeks, but they didn't have the commercial economy. They didn't have the mass media. They didn't have the things that we have now that give us celebrity. So it's a complicated argument. I try and get into it in the book hopefully in a way that's quite straightforward. But yeah, it's hard stuff.
I was delighted to see that there was an Irish connection with one of the, I think not possibly the very first, but a very early celebrity that you point out, Edmund Kean, an actor. Mm. But the Irish connection there is his wife, Mary.
That's right. In fact, there are several people in the book actually with Irish connections. You know, it's lovely actually to see how many fascinating stories started not necessarily in London. You know, they often ended up in London or Paris, but actually a lot of people came from Ireland or from Scotland or from Wales or other parts of Europe. And Mary Keane was an actress. She was not particularly successful, but she was, you know, doing all right. And she married someone called Edmund, and he was this absolute screw up, you know, a wandering actor, a real drink problem, total mess. And it was a pretty sad story for a number of years. At one point, he walked her from Birmingham to Swansea, which is 180 miles, and she was pregnant at the time. So, you know, really not going well. And then Edmund has an overnight success story. He goes from nobody to probably the greatest actor of the 19th century in the space of a week. It's an incredible story. And his poor wife, Mary, was sort of dragged along in that story, and she suffered alongside him. He was a difficult character, but a fascinating one.
And it was a Shakespeare play that kind of broke him, as it were, and broke him into celebrity.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Richard III was his great work, but the play that broke him through was he played Shylock, Merchant of Venice, and that was his that was what made him famous that week. And then suddenly everyone was talking about him.
So that idea of overnight success, how important is that in the whole area of celebrity? I mean, we've always heard it's a famous quote. I think it's Jack Nicholson who said, "Yes, I was an over after One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest." People said overnight success, Jack Nicholson. He said, "Yes, after 15 or 20 years of acting, I became an overnight success." How important is that aspect?
I have to agree with Jack Nicholson. Actually, a huge number of the case studies in my book, actually, they may have appeared to have had imminent success that came from nowhere. You know, Lord Byron is the most famous one, who supposedly wakes up famous, is his quote. But the truth is that most people who became really big stars had been really putting in the hours, and they had been working on their stuff, they'd been developing their skills, they'd been beavering away in the background. Overnight success can happen. It does occasionally happen. It often would happen to people who were either turned into heroes or turned into villains. So Grace Darling was a heroic young lady who rowed out to save some shipwrecked people up in Northumbria. And she was turned into a national hero in the UK. And you see it again with people perhaps who were villainous, you know, maybe a criminal who suddenly is turned into a celebrity criminal overnight. But for performers, for musicians, actors, writers, actually, often it took many years of hard graft, and then they would have a breakout. And that would feel to many people like they'd come from nowhere, which is what happened with Edmund Kean. But in reality, they had been working their socks off.
So then we get to the idea of, as I mentioned earlier on, this idea, you know, vacuity, which seems to be kind of one of the great qualities of some modern day celebrities. Do you have to have a set of skills to acquire or attain celebrity? Or, you know, I suppose I'm answering the question by saying clearly it's not always the case.
You don't. And I suppose what's crucial to point out is that many people more recently in the past sort of 20, 30 years have complained that celebrity these days is, you know, vacuous, superficial, meaningless. There's no talent involved. And there is a little bit of that in there. Sure, we definitely have some celebs. You look at them and go, what do you even do? But what's funny is that when you go back to the 18th century, there were people complaining about the same thing back then. There's a poem from sort of 1786, I think it is, called The Age of Genius, and it complains about all these new celebrities who don't do anything, they've got no talent. And we have celebrities of that period. We have Casanova, who was, you know, we know his name now. He's now known as a great seducer, but at the time he was desperately trying to become famous. He tried all he could to become famous. And there was also Kitty Fisher, who was a professional courtesan, a professional mistress. And she was very clever at manipulating the press in trying to heighten her fame. But she didn't have any skills. She was just beautiful. And this is something we have to get our heads around, because we often try and look at celebrity as a 20th century invention. And we assume, therefore, it must also be a question of things getting progressively worse and modern culture getting, you know, more lowbrow. And it's just not true. There are definitely more celebrities now than there ever were. Of course there are. But there were sort of talentless celebrities in the 18th century and brilliant celebrities. And we have that now. We have Beyoncé, who's, you know, incredible, amazing. What a voice, what a dancer, what a performer. And we also have people who go on Love Island, and, you know, they can coexist. It's not that celebrity is only one thing. It can be many things.
Of course, the people who go on Love Island, or some of the people who go on Love Island, may well know exactly what they're doing and be playing a very clever game at being vacuous and in the process making huge money. But the economic side of this, it's not necessarily just the celebrity that makes the money. You make this argument in the book. It can be the celebrity, in fact, might make none of the money at all. It could go elsewhere.
Yes, you're absolutely right. One of the crucial elements of what celebrity is, and I've got a 5-point checklist in my book, and one of them is that, yeah, not only can people make their own money if they're famous, but celebrity is when other people can make money off their back, when there is a sort of parasitic thing going on there. And it may well be that it's newspaper journalists, paparazzi, bloggers, t-shirt designers, whoever it is. If you can make money off someone else's fame, that's celebrity. And so what's interesting is that celebs could earn good money in the 18th century, you know, really good money. But in the late 19th century is when they first start to cotton on to the fact that they can do advertising deals and sponsorship deals, and they can become the face of products that they sell to their fans. Before that, often their face had been put on products without their permission. But by the 1880s, 1890s, it's starting to happen with their permission, and they're making good money from it.
Who was making the money when it came to Jack the Ripper, who you name as one of the celebrities in your book as well?
Well, that's a great question. And we're talking here about primarily the media, the journalism, you know, with the newspapers at the time. In the 1880s, we have a really interesting boom in tabloid kind of journalism. So you get what's called new journalism coming in, which is all about sport, gossip, criminality. You know, it's much more kind of headline grabbing stuff. The newspapers make good money from the back of this terrifying anonymous killer. But there are also other people, actually, who opened up little streets with theatres. You could go and see the crime scenes. There were wax works done of his victims. There was a kind of pretty, well, I mean, innovative but nasty little economy, really, in the East End of London, where you could go and tour around and see where the crimes had happened. And, yeah, money was attached. People were paying for this access. So we think of Jack the Ripper as this horrifying thing, but he kind of was a celebrity.
There's also this snooty idea, if I might use that word, around celebrity. And, I was a bit at it a bit myself in my introduction when I talked about the vacuousness again. You know, we all say, oh, how come he or she is so famous? They're famous for just being famous. They do nothing. Yet we can't take our eyes off them. What is it about celebrity? What does the viewer get, or the person who watches this celebrity, who wants to know every minute detail of their lives, private and public? What do we get from that?
This is the great million-dollar question, and people have been trying to answer this one for a good 100 years. We can go all the way back to Emil Durkheim, a sociologist in 1912, who said, well, it must be some sort of religious impulse that we're all hardwired to revere and pray, and secularism has come along and you know, replaced religion with these new idols that we all obsess over. I'm not terribly convinced, but it's an interesting argument. There are psychologists who say it's all to do with the fact that we're just basically chimps, and that we are all obsessed with the alpha males in the group, and celebrities are our alpha males, and we just want to watch them and study them and copy them. Again, not that convinced, but it's an interesting thing. For me, what I think is fascinating is that celebrity culture allows us to talk to each other. It allows us a shared experience that we can all gossip over. We can talk to strangers about it, taxi drivers and hairdressers, although obviously these days we're not seeing many of them. But we can talk to our friends and family and strangers about the lives of these strangers we've never met, and yet we know so much about them. And that's a thing called parasocial intimacy, where you've got a one-sided relationship where you know everything there is to know about someone and they don't even know who you are. We can be brought together that way, and we can also enjoy the kind of drama of it all. You know, we can treat celebrities almost as human box sets, and we can enjoy watching them, and then we can decide that we're bored of them and just ditch them, or we can cancel them because they've done something offensive, or we can move on. The truth is, celebrity is like a kind of huge, never-ending soap opera. And for us, you kind of get hooked in, and it's enjoyable and pleasurable, but you can also enjoy rubbishing them. You know, I've got plenty of friends who enjoy celebrity culture in a negative way. They like to rubbish it and mock it and take the mick, and that's pleasurable for them. So it brings us together.
Yeah, in 5 seconds or 10 seconds, give me why, as you claim in the book, Jesus Christ is the ultimate celebrity.
Well, I don't claim that, but he is perhaps the most famous person in history. I wouldn't say he's a celebrity, but he certainly is, you know, incredibly influential around the world. But of course, he's also one of the most invoked, most written about, most discussed people, and the media is a fundamental part of it. So Jesus Christ would certainly, you know, do very well in the rankings if you were going to measure it. But I wouldn't say celebrity. I'd say, you know, renowned fame. And obviously, he's, you know, he's more than just an ordinary celebrity.
Fair enough. That's Greg Jenner there speaking to me about his book Dead Famous, which is published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. One of the most influential and indeed divisive characters in British comedy, Ricky Gervais, returns to our screens today with the second season of his Netflix comedy drama Afterlife. The series, which stars Gervais as a depressed newspaper reporter struggling to readjust to life following the death of his wife, has received rave reviews, with some critics calling it Gervais's finest work. But how does it compare to his groundbreaking workplace dramedy, The Office? And is this new season of Afterlife as good as the first season of Afterlife? And Chris Wasser joins me now to discuss this very point. For the uninitiated, first of all, Chris, tell us about the basic setup of Afterlife and the idea of the character of Tony. What we found out about him in season one, Tony, played by Ricky Gervais.
Well, what we see of Ricky Gervais' Tony Johnson in season one is that he is a 50-something features editor. He's also a reporter for the Tambury Gazette. Tambury being this, you know, picture postcard town almost, where he lived with his wife Lisa for 20, 25 years. And unfortunately, she has died tragically following a lengthy battle with cancer. But she left behind a series of video messages where Lisa, who's portrayed by the actress Kerry Goldman, she gives him all of these video messages in a sort of a PS I love you kind of way, that, you know, he can watch every morning before he goes to work, or he can watch every evening before he goes to sleep. You know, stuff like inspirational messages to keep him going, because I think she knew that he was going to be a bit of a mess after she died. Mm. But, you know, and he is exactly that. He is quite depressed. He stopped caring about everyone. He is actually quite suicidal. And he's decided that apart from his dog, Brandy, he's not going to be nice to anyone or anything in the whole world. And he's decided also that there are no consequences for his actions. So he can be as mean as possible to everyone in his life, from his workmates to, you know, the few friends that he has around him. And if there are consequences for his actions, as he says, he will literally kill himself. And this worries a lot of people. So a lot of people in the town, and most of them who actually work with him on the Tambury Gazette, this local free sheet, they kind of band together and try each and every one of them to make him a better person. So you have this a local sex worker by the name of Daphne, played by the great Roisin Conaty. She becomes a pal of Tony. She tries to make him a better person, to, you know, to see that there's more to life, that he can still lead a rewarding, fulfilling life. But he also befriends a local woman by the name of Anne. She's actually an elderly widow, and she spends a lot of time in the afternoons in the cemetery when Tony is actually visiting the grave of his wife. So they form a bit of a relationship. And then, of course, you have a potential new love interest in the form of Nurse Emma, played by Ashley Jensen, who has collaborated with Ricky Gervais on most of his shows after The Office. And they kind of bond as she cares for his father with Alzheimer's in the home. So there's an awful lot going on around this man who essentially is quite depressed following the death of his wife.
But to be fair, by the end of season one, there was a kind of a glimmer of hope that perhaps nasty old Tony was beginning to soften up. And I wondered, as I watched the first episode of season two today, I wondered as I was watching it, whoa, are we going to get the soft version of Tony? But I was quickly put to rights on that one. Let's listen to a clip which will give us a sense of it. Actually, Roxy, I think, might be the sex worker name that the Roisin Conaty character uses. And here she is walking in unannounced into Tony, played by Ricky Gervais, into his kitchen, much to his annoyance.
Come in.
What?
Nothing.
Oh, what, me just letting myself in?
Well, some would have knocked. I could have been naked.
I could see through the door you weren't naked.
Well, that doesn't make any sense. If I'd have been naked, you'd look through the door and seen me naked.
Yeah, and I wouldn't have come in.
But you'd have seen me naked.
Wouldn't have bothered me.
That's all right then. What would you have done?
What do you mean?
You come to the door, you see me naked, you don't come in. What then?
I'd have knocked.
So now, I'm here naked, I hear a knock, I look up, I see you looking through at me. What'd you do? Fucking wave.
I don't know. Maybe I wouldn't knock. Maybe I'd just sneak off. Anyway, why are you sat at a table naked like some weird Monty Python sketch?
That's my business. My house, my rules.
Don't you sit at the table naked,
no,
then?
No, I've got a dog. I don't want to see in that.
There you go. Roisin Conaty and Ricky Gervais there in a scene from season two, first episode, in fact, of season two of Afterlife. And Chris Wasser is speaking to me about it this evening. You know, even as you listen to Ricky Gervais there, how far away are we from David Brent. How far away are we from Ricky Gervais as he presents the Golden Globes and insults everybody in the audience? How far away are we from any of those Ricky Gervais characters, Chris?
Well, we're quite far away from the David Brent character, and we're quite far away from anything we would have seen in Extras or Life's Too Short or Derek, even the shows that Ricky Gervais created, wrote, directed and starred in previous to this. But at the same time, it's quite, I think Ricky Gervais is one of those talents, one of those actors who it doesn't matter what sort of character he's playing, maybe because he's always been behind the writing process with his characters, that it's impossible not to think, how much of Ricky Gervais are we seeing here? You know, where does Tony End and Ricky Gervais begin, essentially. But it is nice to see Gervais portray an ordinary man in an ordinary setup and to move away finally from the mockumentary type setting. And you know, maybe that was a decision that he felt forced to make, you know, some 17 or 18 years after The Office finished, because everything that Gervais has done since The Office, I mean, The Office took off as a franchise. There are various international versions of it, the UK one being hugely successful in America, but the American one then, you know, had a life of its own. If the UK version only ran for 2 years, the American one ran for 10 or 11 years. So that was quite a huge success, but it's always seemed that Gervais kind of wanted to prove that he wasn't just a one-trick pony. And though he's been enormously successful in other TV projects and with his stand-up, this is sort of the project that, you know, fans of his, and also maybe you're thinking Gervais himself, thinks, you know, look, now I can finally prove that there is more to me here. And perhaps also the fact that this is his first television series for Netflix has allowed him to be, you know, a little bit different in his writing, because this is actually the first time that he sold a show to a streaming service. I mean, previously he worked with Sky, BBC, ITV, Channel 4, all terrestrial networks, but I don't imagine a terrestrial network would have allowed Gervais to get away with what the kind of content that he's put into Afterlife, because he was given actual, you know, final edit and final control of the episodes here, and the stuff that happened. I mean, I gave you a rundown of the premise earlier, and it is quite bleak, but there is comedy in there, as you would have heard from the first clip, you know, to soften that blow. But the humor goes to some really dark places that I can't imagine a terrestrial network would have allowed.
Yeah, I mean, there's a hilariously funny scene in the first episode, where he goes to yoga with his brother-in-law, who's now separated from the Gervaises, or from Tony's sister. And it's just, you know, laugh out loud at every minute during that scene. But then there are scenes like in the home where his father, where Tony's father is and suffering from Alzheimer's, as you say, and being looked after by the nurse, when you'd want to be made of stone not to be moved by it. I mean, there's a scene where the father mixes Tony up as if, is it his own brother or is it his brother's kid? It's absolutely heartbreaking.
It is. It's incredibly moving. And the weird thing about this show is that sometimes, as I said, you're wondering sometimes where Tony ends and Ricky Gervais begins. Sometimes he kind of, you know, he can't help himself. Gervais, that is. And he, you know, he has said before that Tony, you know, originally the idea for Tony was this as this living embodiment of, you know, the fight, the so-called fight against PC culture or whatever that is supposed to mean. And that's how Tony is allowed to get away with some of the things he's saying. So that's why we have some shocking scenes in place or some humor that you're thinking, oh, that's a bit too close to the bone, Gervais, that's a bit too risque. And then in 30 seconds he can turn that on his head with a scene like the one you mentioned where he's sitting with his father and his father can't quite recall, you know, who he is or the fact that Lisa has died. And it's not surprising to find that Gervais might actually be capable of something like that, because he has said before that one of his favourite films, and this is quite hard to believe, but one of his favourite films is It's a Wonderful Life. So it's no surprise that he eventually got around to creating what is essentially his own George Bailey moment. There's a bit of an Ebenezer Scrooge vibe in there too, but if you're going to go down that path, you have to have a heart in place. And as we would have seen from the best of The Office and some of the finer scenes and Extras too, he is capable of the kind of comedy that can charm audiences. Yes, he can shock you, but he can also charm you. And I think it's those scenes where he's talking to his father, or at least trying to communicate with his dad, but also the scenes with Penelope Wilton's Anne in the cemetery, where he finally finds the this one person away from work with whom he can actually share his feelings, and the two of them talk about the people that they've lost. I thought for a moment while watching it, is this unscripted? Is this just all done off the cuff? Did they just keep rolling and see what the two of them could come up with? It's not crude. It's not gross. And sometimes they're in tears and you're in tears watching it. It's some of the finest stuff that he's done. I almost wish he didn't, you know, I can actually imagine what it might have been like had Afterlife just taken place on that bench with those two characters. So he is capable of charming you.
Yeah, those scenes, as you say, with Penelope Wilton sitting on the bench in front of the grave of her character's husband, really heartbreaking as well. But the problem with Ricky Gervais, I think, for many people, I spoke to one colleague today who basically said, I don't care how good Afterlife is, hope I'm not paraphrasing now, but it's Ricky Gervais and I just can't take it, because there's a real Marmite feel for around Ricky Gervais. Some people just do not like what he does, do not like him outside of his work, you know, and that's always a problem, isn't it, when we're saying, well, I don't like what's he talking about when he says PC culture and kind of dismisses it? What's he talking about there? Do we have to separate the man from the artist and just look at the artist and accept his work?
It is a tricky to do when Ricky Gervais is involved, because, as I say, you are seeing some of, or, you know, if not a lot of his own personality shining through. And that's such a shame, because there are moments in Afterlife and there are some characters, you know, I don't want to spoil anything, but there are some characters in season two and some setups involving, you know, political and social stances and material that, you know, you think Gervais was actually, you know, he was maybe at one stage trying to work into a stand-up routine, but he thought, no, look, I'll use it on these characters or these storylines, that you're thinking that's completely unnecessary, and there's a bit of mean-spiritedness in there that's hard to stomach. You know, as much as I was charmed by this series and as funny as it can be at times, it's also quite disgusting at times too, which is an awful shame, because, as you said, Gervais has become, you know, this divisive Marmite figure, and he's become something of a poster boy for this so-called anti-PC brigade, which is, you know, a lot of, and you see it in a lot of comedians who have come out over the last few years and said the kind of thing that, you know, oh, you can't say anything anymore, you can't get away with anything, and they want that, you know, they think it's their God-given right to joke about anything they want. It's not if there's going to be consequences involved, and Gervais is one of those guys who just will push and push until he gets a reaction, and there is a bit too much of that in season two. I mean, there is one sequence involving gender identity, which I don't know, I will be looking to see how that goes down with viewers over the next week or two, and I think that's a shame, because he can be so talented and brilliant, and you're seeing flashes of that in this season.
Right, well, a few caveats in there, and maybe watching season one first might soften you up if you're heading into season two. That's Chris Wasser speaking to us about Afterlife, and season two is available to stream on Netflix from today. And you're listening to Friday Night's Arena. Friday used to mean the start of the weekend. Not sure how much that applies anymore, but Friday night does still mean album night here on the programme. And joining me this evening, Siobhan Kane and Simon Marr, who've been listening to new work from Lucinda Williams, Ezra Farman, and Irish artist Delush. We'll kick off with Lucinda Williams and her album, which is called Good Souls, Better Angels. This is a song called Waking Up.
He wants a kiss on me after all this. He wants a kiss on me, but I'm waking up from a bad dream. I'm shaking up. It was a bad scene, but I'm waking up.
Waking Up, one of the songs from Lucinda Williams and her new album, Good Souls, Better Angels. Her 14th album, in fact. She released her first back in 1972. I read a recent interview where she says, I don't mind pushing people's buttons. Is she pushing people's buttons in this album, Siobhan Kane?
She's pushing her own buttons, I suppose it could be argued, Sean. She's kind of having a reckoning with herself as well as what she sees around her, a huge disappointment with her own country that she loves very much. And quite a few of these songs on the record are definitely dedicated to Mr. Trump. So it's strange that it's released today. We're in the midst of a pandemic worldwide, which is both unifying and divisive. And she kind of course, has been working on this. She's always notorious as kind of a slow worker, very methodical the last few years. And this is just, she's been galvanized by the Trump administration since 2016. And she's been working on this record for the last few years. So, yeah, it's a heavy record in a brilliant way.
Yeah, maybe aimed at rather than dedicated to Mr. Trump, I think, possibly in the case of Lucinda Williams. As Simon Marr, we get a sense of the swampy blues country feel that's in there. But that voice, wow, it's an incredible vocal instrument, really.
Oh, it really is, Sean. Like, what she does, there's such a roughness to it, and it's almost, it's an acquired roughness, because she's 60, must be 67 now at this stage, but her voice started off probably back almost sounded like more in a country twang to it when you go back 15, 20 years. But as time has gone on, it's got rougher, she's got angrier, and she just sounds better and better as the albums go on. And she sounds, what she's able to do is she's able to do anger very well, but when she does the more soft, the more tender stuff, the voice is still there. Even though it's rasping, it still just sounds lovely.
But anger can, if you're listening to too much of it and you feel you're being shouted at or preached at, Siobhan, it can wear you down across the album. Does she manage that balance between, you know, giving her message and entertaining us musically?
She really does. It's actually one of the best pieces of work I think she's done in her 40-year career. I mean, her record that kind of crossed her over was Car Wheels on a Gravel Road in 98. But this is where she was saying, she was kind of going back to Cohen, Dylan and Cave to kind of, she wanted that kind of thing of the protest song of Masters of War or A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall by Dylan. Protest meets kind of Old Testament reckoning with Nick Cave and the earlier work, and then she's meeting it with Lucinda Williams. I mean, she's the only one that's from the South. You know, Cohen, Cave and Dylan have this kind of Southern Gothic element to some of their work, but Lucinda Williams is from Louisiana. Her father, you know, Miller Williams, professor of poetry, Flannery O'Connor was his mentor. She's dyed in the wool Southern Gothic, and that's coming into the mix. So it's this weird mixture of protest record, what she's seeing around her, and also completely melodic. The guitar, I keep reading that people say there's the death of the guitar in music, and if anything was to say it's alive and well, it's this record. The guitar on this record is just center stage, beautiful, and she's, again, anger as constructive energy. It's just this 67-year-old woman is taking on the world, basically.
Well, let's go to the final track on the album, actually, where I think the anger has abated somewhat, and that title is so uplifting, the overall album title, Good Souls, Better Angels. And in fact, it's there in the final track as well. Let's have a listen to a bit of Good Souls.
But I stray from the past.
Well, if there's loads of anger in tracks 1 to 11, certainly when we get to track 12, we're in a whole different mood altogether. And I think, Simon Marr, that was one of the songs that really stood out for you in the album, a whole 7 minutes of it. Just give us why it rounds the album off for you, first of all, Simon, and finish up by giving us stars overall.
That's the, like, it's amazing is what she's able to do, and I'm always madly jealous of people who can do this, is she's able to humanize whatever emotion that it is she wants to get across. You know, we all find it so difficult to express those emotions, and the fact that she can do it so well in music is something amazing. And when you compare those two tracks, when you compare Waking Up, and it's very, very destined, very big but quite defined, and then Good Souls, which, as I say, it's seven and a half minutes, and it's just luscious. It's luscious, and her vocal is luscious on it. And again, I'm immensely jealous. So, but this album is really, really good. It's very much worth a listen. And whether you're listening to this, or as Siobhan said earlier on, whether you're listening to Car Wheels on a Gravel Road, either way, it's great stuff. This is a solid 4 out of 5 for me.
4 from you, Simon. What are you saying, Siobhan?
I'm saying 4 out of 5, actually, because she kind of ends on a prayerful note. So I'm going to give it a 4.5.
A 4.5 from you. Let us move on then to Delush, also known as musician Enda Gallery. His debut album is called Journey to Zero. Siobhan, just tell me a little bit about Enda Gallery and how we might know him in previous existence, as it were.
Well, he's an interesting artist in that he's been beavering away for some time, and made, in the last 6 to 7 years, he's made Berlin his home, and he's worked with various artists, collaborating on production duties from the electronic and hip hop scenes. And then he was working for major labels over there as well, and got to the point where he thought he himself had been privately working as a musician and kind of trying to harness and focus his own voice, and felt that he'd gotten to the point where he was supporting a lot of other people and wanted to kind of pair it back for his own self. So this is a project that's been emerging for the last few years. And he's collaborated with two Irish artists on two of the songs that are from the record.
Yeah.
But he had decided that he was very kind of, he wanted to do a kind of a song cycle that's based around Joseph Campbell's The Hero with a Thousand Faces, about that thing that a lot of we all, it's familiar with to all of us, about the idea from mythology, from the Odyssey and beyond, about the hero that goes, meets obstacles, comes back with lessons learned and has been transformed. So this is what the record is based around, that idea.
Right. One of the Irish musicians that's featured on the album is the Limerick rapper Strange Boy, and he's on this track that I want to listen to now called It's All Right.
Dedicated to contemplation. You want a nice plot and plan, you need validation. Waiting for perfect.
Oh, that rapping is just amazing from Strange Boy, Limerick rapper Strange Boy, as part of that track, It's All Right, from the new Delush album, The Journey to Zero. That album title gives us a sense of what he's trying to do here, Simon Marr. In fact, he had been part of a duo previously, hadn't he, called Kill the Manna, which gives us his Tala roots. But he seems to want to basically restart, set to zero and go again.
Absolutely. And I'd been listening to Kill the Manna for 3 or 4 years now and never, ever made the connection from the time they released an album, 2017, they released an album called Paradise Suicide that was really, really good. And they announced last year, they released a couple of final EPs that were really, really good and said, look, we want to go off and do our own thing. Miguel was the other half of Kill the Manna, went one way. But Enda obviously had a story to tell and he wanted to do that. And it feels like it was a journey. He'd done 6 years in Berlin. He wanted to come home musically at least. And the question now will always be as to, okay, well, where do you go to from here?
And where do you think he can go to from here? Do you think he's achieved what he wanted to? Has he got back to, has he pressed the reset button on this album?
I think he definitely has. I think he's definitely done that. But you can see itself, and he talks himself a lot about how he had his own, you know, mental health difficulties going back over a long number of years. And he said he found a way of expressing that through music. And I think he wanted to get, it's almost as if those songs were inside him and all of these stories were inside and they have to get out. But now that he's back at that point, you get the feeling this is where, creatively at least, he can really make a new start on it. And he seems genuinely excited by it. And that's a really good thing.
Yeah, and the It's All Right track that we heard gives one particular style that you hear in a couple of tracks on the album, you know, a kind of a more upbeat and rappy hip-hop feel to it. But in other tracks, there's this real soulful quality, and an absence of ego is exactly what he's talking about in the track I want to listen to now, which is called Don't Let Me Win.
But don't let me win. Don't let me win. Just because I am so good at arguing, don't let me win. Don't let me win.
Super. What a beautiful, beautiful voice that he has there. Delush on the track, Don't Let Me Win. That's a totally different side to the man. Very tender, very moving. I wanted to listen to that song about 3 or 4 times today. Overall, did the album work for you, Siobhan Kane and Stars?
I would say yes, and another element that probably we didn't really maybe get to was there's an ambient wash over a lot of the record, which brings to mind people like How to Dress Well and Washed Out, that some listeners would be familiar with. So there's really interesting places he's taking us. For now, I feel I'm landing on a 3.5 because it was kind of many things, but I'm interested to see where he's going to take it next.
What are you saying overall, Simon?
I think 3.5 is a very fair mark. There's one thing I was particularly impressed with on it was that despite all the sort of production, he's gone away and he's got his master's in music production, is that it's not fussy. It just sounds really, really good. The stories are good, the stories are honest, but it hasn't been drowned in production. So yeah, 3.5 is very fair.
3.5 from both of you then for Delush and his album Journey to Zero. Final album we're talking about this evening comes from Ezra Furman, and it's the soundtrack, the original soundtrack to the Netflix series Sex Education. So maybe first of all, Siobhan, give us a context here. What is Sex Education, the Netflix series, and who is Ezra Furman?
Yes, so, oh goodness, so Sex Education, quite a lot of listeners will be very familiar with its second season now, and apparently after hopefully this pandemic has abated, it will get a third. It's kind of become a bit of a phenomenon, and Ezra Furman is almost the exact, kind of the perfect person to soundtrack, and his, you know, he kind of soundtracks so many different parts of each episode, and Ezra is somebody that has gone on, I guess, their own journey over the last decade. The last record was just phenomenal. But also this particular soundtrack takes in work from Ezra's older life, I could argue, I guess, kind of from the Year of No Returning, 2012, to Day of the Dog, 2013. And Transgelic Exodus, which was 2 years ago, 2018. And then also kind of implementing some covers that mean a lot to Ezra, from The Clovers' 1956 doo-wop's Devil or Angel to Melanie's Good Book from 1971, and then LCD Sound System's I Can Change from 2010. So it's a really, in an interesting way, in terms for Ezra as well as an artist, it's a really interesting panoramic overview of Ezra's career to date. But also there's some original material in there as well that Ezra has created specifically for this particular series. So it's really, it's kind of a really interesting thing.
Yeah, the series is set in an English secondary school, as far as I remember from the few episodes I saw of the first season. And it really is all about the young teenagers, their sexual awakening in all of its forms and ways. So let's listen to a track from the album, or from the soundtrack as it is. This track is Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
That's my Dr. Jekyll.
And there we go. That's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde from Ezra Furman and the soundtrack to the Netflix series Sex Education. Simon, where does this fit into Ezra Furman's work? I know Siobhan gave us a sense of it there.
Yeah, it's very different. Like when you think the last album was 12 Nudes, it was only released, I think we reviewed it on Arena only last September, and it's a very angry road record. They're on tour and it's very punky. Whereas this is something that has to be really specific, and he has to put specific pieces to specific stories within the series, and it shows an amazing flexibility to be able to do the punky thing that he can do, but also to be able to really pair it right the way back. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, I think, sums up not just him, but sums up the TV programme and the soundtrack of it perfectly.
Yeah, but do you need to know, you know, where the, in other words, do the songs exist really by themselves outside of the Sex Education series? You know, do you need to know where it fits into the story that you've been told on the television? I'll stick with you on that one, Simon.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. I listened through to the album, I think, on Wednesday afternoon, and then on Wednesday evening I watched my first three episodes ever of the program, never having seen it before. So no, it makes no difference whatsoever. While it works as a companion piece, obviously, if you've seen the TV show, even without it, this is 1920, very, very strong pieces of music that show the breadth of work that Ezra Furman can do, and the fact that he can change not just within a song, not just within an album, but he has the ability to change within a verse, which is an amazing thing. But and it's so good. Really, really is so good.
Stars from you, Simon.
I'm going to give this 4 out of 5, and definitely worth an hour and a half of your listening time. Very much so, with or without the TV programme.
And it is a long album, Siobhan. Did it hold your attention for the entirety, and stars from you?
Yes, 19 songs for me, Sean, weren't long enough. I mean, he ends in The Queen of Hearts, which was 2012 he composed it, which is very prescient because he talks about writing music in a bedroom for a film that will never be made. And then, of course, it accompanies Sex Education, a series that did get made. So for me, he encompasses teenage angst poetically and beautifully, and it's dizzying heights for me. So it's a 5 out of 5, actually.
A 5 out of 5 wow. from Siobhan Kane for Ezra Furman and the original soundtrack to Sex Education. And before that, Siobhan and Simon Marr told us about Delush and his album The Journey to Zero and Lucinda Williams' album Good Souls, Better Angels. That is our lot for this evening. Indeed, for this week here in Arena, Paula Sheaves and Leah Murphy research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. In fact, let me mention that I've been broadcasting from home for the last while, and these three people couldn't do it without them, particularly those in studio tonight. Janice Furphy, the broadcast coordinator, Kieran Cullen on sound, and the programme produced by Olin McGann. Thanks particularly to all three of them and to the entire team. Talk to you next week, once again, Monday, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1.